From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the war in Bosnia. We talk with James Adams, the Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times of London, about what could be done to end the conflict there. He says we need to do more than just table thumping. Also, Vietnam after the war. We talk with Neil Sheehan about his recent visit there, the first time he's been back since the fall of Saigon in 1975. Sheehan was Vietnam correspondent for the New York Times, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for A Bright Shining Lie, his book about America's involvement in Vietnam. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new Gary Shandling show on HBO. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United States, Mexico, and Canada announced agreement today on a plan to form the world's largest single free trade zone. The North American Free Trade Agreement would encompass 350 million people in a single market, producing goods and services worth more than $6 trillion a year. The agreement was announced today by President Bush, who called it the beginning of a new era on the North American continent. The pact must still be approved by Congress and the legislatures of Mexico and Canada. Critics say the agreement would draw U.S. manufacturing jobs to Mexico, where labor is cheaper, and would also degrade environmental safeguards. U.S. and Mexican human rights organizations filed an international complaint today alleging frequent human rights abuses on the U.S.-Mexican border. NPR's Pas Cohen reports.
The complainants want the Organization of American States Human Rights Commission to find the U.S. government in violation of international human rights standards. They claim Latin Americans and Hispanic U.S. citizens are beaten, shot, sometimes killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents, and that neither the Bush administration nor the U.S. courts have done anything to end the violence. Attorney Peter Shea.
The migrant victims of these shootings are not criminals, nor are they drug smugglers. They are poor peasants. They may or may not deserve visas to enter this country, but they certainly do not deserve to die.
A spokesman for the Immigration Service, which oversees the Border Patrol, dismissed the charges as a blatant attempt to make our laws immune from enforcement. I'm Pas Cohen in Washington.
The Bush-Quayle campaign and Republican Party leaders signaled the official start of a negative general election campaign today. The party's national chairman, Rich Bond, went after both Bill and Hillary Clinton in an attempt to redefine the opposition. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bond called Clinton Slick Willie in a speech today at the opening of the party's summer meeting. He referred to the campaign's bus tour as Slick Willie and Al His Pal's Magical Mystery Tour, a tour that, if successful, he said, would propel liberal Democrats into the cabinet and seriously undermine the nation's values.
It's a battle between their view of America and our view of America. Their values versus our values. So pick Hollywood or Huntsville, Greenwich Village or Greensboro, Cambridge, Massachusetts or Columbus, Ohio.
Bond went after the Democrat-controlled Congress for stalling the administration's domestic initiatives and the press for biased coverage. State chairs who heard Bond's speech said the negative tone wasn't troubling, but that they hoped there would be an equal emphasis on President Bush's second-term agenda. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Houston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 10 points to close at 3,320. This is NPR. The Senate made some further adjustments today to its $32.5 billion tax bill. In a reversal of an earlier position, the Senate agreed to deny tax-deductible individual retirement accounts to the richest 4% of Americans. The Senate also approved a tax credit of up to $2,500 for some people who buy a new home by the end of the year. The members rejected a Republican plan to cut taxes on capital gains. Final action on the measure has been delayed until after Congress returns from recess in September. In New York, millionaire environmentalist Lawrence Rockefeller has failed to qualify for the Republican primary election ballot in his bid to unseat incumbent Senator Al D'Amato. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
Lawrence Rockefeller is the nephew of the late New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller and a cousin of West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller, but the family name carried no special weight with the State Board of Elections. Rockefeller submitted only a few hundred more than the 10,000 signatures required to qualify for the ballot, and the board validated fewer than 7,000 of them. New York's election laws are considered among the most archaic in the country, with petitions sometimes rejected for technicalities like having pages out of order. The head of New York's government reform group, Common Cause, said Rockefeller's failure to qualify is new evidence of the need to rewrite what he calls the state's Kafkaesque ballot access law. Rockefeller's challenge in federal court, scheduled for tomorrow, may be moot. He was seeking to lower the number of required signatures to 7,500, but by today's count, he would still fall short. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
Avant-garde composer John Cage died today in Manhattan. He was 79. Cage was credited with revolutionizing American music in the 20th century. He was noted for the idea that music doesn't even have to consist of sounds, but can be anything that takes place during a fixed duration in time. His pieces included radios, tape recordings, and an automatic blender. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The United Nations Security Council is considering the authorization of force to ensure the safety of food and medicine being delivered to Bosnia-Herzegovina. While the resolution calls for a negotiated settlement to the fighting, it also allows for armed intervention in the region in coordination with the United Nations. The formal vote in the Council is scheduled for tomorrow. Today, hoping to head off the use of military force, Serbian fighters allowed women and children to leave the besieged city of Sarajevo. The Serbian parliament in Bosnia pledged that they would cooperate with the Security Council. And earlier, the International Committee of the Red Cross was given permission to inspect some Serbian detention camps. James Adams doesn't take these Serbian concessions seriously. He is the Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times of London and has specialized in covering military and defense issues. We wanted to talk with Adams today while military options are being considered. Adams is critical of the United Nations and says the world community should have done more to end the fighting in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Forceful denunciations are great, and you can say this is an appalling state of affairs, and you can bang the table and attack people for being disgusting. Well, fine. But you have to then have behind that some kind of focus, either political or military or both, that says, I'm telling you that you are behaving disgracefully and you have to do better, and if you don't, these things are going to occur. So what we've had so far is lots of denunciation and lots of table thumping, but nothing to follow on.
The UN Secretary Bucis Bucis-Ghali, in talking about the conflict in that region, foresees another Vietnam, another Lebanon, a military quagmire. He also said that there are other parts of the world that are embroiled in civil wars where people are starving, people being tortured and raped and murdered. Do you see this as the same kind of political/military quagmire that Bucis Bucis-Ghali does?
Well, he's right in that he is concerned that this will become the UN's Vietnam. He sees blue berets dragged down and with heavy loss of life with no end and so on, and he may be right in that. That depends on how the military options are handled in the future. The fact that there are other conflicts going on in the world, that millions are starving in Somalia, that there are insurrections on all the continents, is not an argument for doing nothing about Yugoslavia. Quite the reverse. It's an argument for being very forceful in Yugoslavia because it is the thing that is on the front agenda for every member of the Security Council and most nations in the world. It's the one that's getting the publicity. It's the one that people are paying attention to. Therefore, you address that, and hopefully the lessons learned in Yugoslavia will be brought home to those people in other countries. And so we must do something. It's not an argument for doing nothing.
Well, why not lift the arms embargo? Let Bosnia defend itself, as several Islamic countries have called for. Before you bring in, or before outside countries get involved, why not let the country defend itself?
Well, I think that that is a very naive perspective, with all respect to Margaret Thatcher, who has been one of those most forcefully articulating it. You can't just stand back and say, all right, we think these bunch of strange people with strange-sounding names in a country far away that we don't really care about can really kill each other with impunity. Therefore, we'll allow them to have as many weapons as they like, and if 100,000 die, well, there you go, that's life. The fact that one side has got rather fewer arms, many fewer arms than the other, is unfortunate, but merely a reason why we need to do something to prevent the killing. In Nigeria, when there was the civil war and the Biafrans were outgunned, we didn't say, well, let's just give the Biafrans as many weapons as they want. That's a crazy way to go on. You then end up with escalation in every civil war, and you allow each civil war to sort itself out. Well, that's not international diplomacy. That's not international responsibility. That's not looking after every nation's strategic interest. That's not what the United Nations is about.
What should the objectives be if military force is used in the region? Should Milosevic be removed from power? Should Serbian military bases be destroyed? Should there be sanctions imposed and backed up by force against Serbia?
Well, I think you ask a series of very critical questions to which we have as yet no clear answer. One of the problems in dealing with this whole conflict is that there is no clear policy. There is no, we want to be at this point and at this time, and this is what we need to do to achieve this. So our policy so far has been, we need to get aid. Well, fine, okay. What does aid mean? How much aid? To whom? And how long for? These questions have not really been asked or answered. What sort of governments do we want to see established? What democracies do we want to see established? Where do we want borders to exist? All these things, which are very fraught questions, have not been addressed, which is one of the reasons why the military are so nervous about any involvement at all. Well, I don't think, personally, that we should get involved in saying, well, any leader should be overthrown, and that's a precondition, or that we want this particular type of government to be established, or that we want this particular regime to hold sway over this other regime. What we want to do is to bring the different factions round the table, and using our, and I use our in the sort of global context of Western interested governments perhaps, to use our good offices to make them agree a settlement which they will all abide by. Now, we can't really impose anything, I don't think, in this environment. What we can say is, what we want is you all to sit round a table and we will broker a deal, and then we will make sure that you all stand by it. And if you don't, there will be heavy penalties and they will run along these lines. But we can't really set out to establish different governments in the different countries and agree the borders and patrol the borders and so on and so on. That would be an absolutely unending problem that we cannot provide a solution to.
But if the objective is, as you say, to bring warring people to the table together, do you do that by destroying military bases? Do you do that by freeing people from detention camps? Do you do that by blowing up roads?
Well, that again is the key issue. How do you get from here to there? If you accept that your goal is to get the parties to sit round a table, how do you achieve that? There are a range of military options that are being considered and that will be submitted to different governments in the next 48 hours or so. They will concentrate on two different things. One is the delivery of aid, and probably simply to Sarajevo. And the second would be, how do you then use force, or do you use force, and if you do, how do you use force to persuade different groups to sit around the same table? The aid, each of these things is intermingled, and the aid question is very difficult. There are two primary options. One is to control a corridor from the coast, probably up to Sarajevo, with troops on the ground. So you create a safe passageway, if you like, through which aid convoys run. That is going to be very expensive in manpower and very difficult to sustain in a very hostile guerrilla environment. Second, you can run troops in armed convoys with aid convoys with armed troops supporting them up from point A to point B. That is difficult because you essentially have to fight your way through, and you can only do that in limited numbers, and because you don't control the environment, you will potentially lose large numbers of troops. So either of those things are difficult, very difficult, and will involve loss of life among UN forces or allied forces or whoever actually goes in on the ground.
But getting aid to the people of Sarajevo, is that any way to pressure Serbs and others to the negotiation table? Or is it just keeping people alive while the fighting continues?
Well, that's the point, of course. Just delivering aid, I mean, to be perfectly brutal about it, you don't really care if, I mean, you care, but it doesn't matter in the military context if a bunch of civilians and or military fighters die as a consequence of a civil war. What you want is to stop the war itself. You don't merely producing aid as a palliative is not an answer. What you have to do is to say, and indeed you actually might argue that giving aid to people who are fighting is a bad idea because you enable them to fight longer and therefore you sustain the conflict. But I think that's a sort of slightly marginal thing. But what you want to try and do is to force people by making them pay a price to recognize that conflict is not the answer and that there must be a better solution. And you offer them a solution that perhaps is a worthwhile and welcome alternative.
Would that price be then bombing military targets in Serbia?
Well, that is certainly one solution. And one of the military reservations, one of the reservations the military have, and not just the Pentagon, but the Minister of Defense in London, the French, and so on, all share, is that the politicians have not articulated a clear military goal. The environment in Yugoslavia is incredibly hostile, very difficult terrain, a lot of urban area, very difficult to sort out who is friend and who is enemy. They have very mobile systems that they can switch around, anti-tank systems and so on, which are difficult to deal with. So if what we have on our side is a reluctance to commit ground forces, understandably, but we also have a very substantial technological edge, what in military parlance is a standoff capability. So we potentially can hit them without them being able to hit us. Now, that deals with the problem of the ground environment, our commitment of ground troops. It leaves you with the problem of what do you do with the UN forces, and aren't they vulnerable? Well, yes, they are. But provided you have your targets selected properly, you can do things from the air that make them pay a price. And the advantage of it, of course, is that you can readily escalate your response. So let us say you send in a strike and you take out an artillery position and you say, right, well, we've done that. We've killed 50 of your guys. You do anything to the UN forces and we'll do 20 times that. And then you don't like that, we'll do 100 times that. And you can escalate it with relatively small cost to your own side and very high cost to their side.
What is known about how the Serbian army is armed? For instance, where do they get their armaments? And how formidable an army are they?
Well, if you look at them on paper, and you say, well, they've got so many APCs, so many anti-tank missiles, they're not great. If you look at them in terms of terrain, environment, capability, commitment, then they're very impressive. You don't need, if you're fighting on an open plain, you need 500 anti-tank missiles. If you're fighting to take out 10 tanks, let's say. If you're fighting in an environment that you know very well, you need a fraction of that number. So they are a very effective fighting force, particularly operating as a guerrilla army. If you're looking at them taking on the best of NATO, a NATO division head on, they'd be absolutely wiped out in a fraction of a moment. But that's not what they're doing. They're fighting in a guerrilla war in a very brutal way in an environment very friendly to them. They're getting their arms both on the international market, and Yugoslavia has been a bonanza for the illegal arms dealers in recent months. And they're also, without any doubt whatsoever, being supplied from the Yugoslav armories.
My guest today on Fresh Air is James Adams, and he's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times of London. And we're talking about Bosnia-Herzegovina and if military force is used there, what that force might look like and what some of those objects or the objectives might be. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with James Adams, and he's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times of London. How do you think the geography of that region will pose problems for the military, if indeed military force is used? What kinds of weapons, what kinds of tactics do you think will be forced because of the geography of the region?
Well, from a modern warfare point of view, it is absolutely the worst environment you can imagine. If you're an attacker using what we have in terms of conventional firepower, mountains, hills, forests, urban areas, local people who know the terrain extremely well, blurred borders, you name every military guy's nightmare, this is it. And what the people on the ground already there have is anti-tank systems, mobile artillery systems, mortars, small arms. So they're very highly mobile, able to attack and move on their own territory and largely on their own terms.
Obviously, you're painting a very different picture from the war in the Persian Gulf.
Oh, it's completely different, because the war in the Persian Gulf was an opportunity to apply mass, conventional force mass, in a very friendly terrain in comparison, because you had mobility, you could move very large forces relatively quickly, you could have open area battles, you could use smart weapons, you could use standoff systems, you could use satellites, all the things that we have, that we use to such great effect that NATO armies are trained to use, don't really apply at all in Yugoslavia. On the contrary, the systems that we have are often useless. Satellite imagery will be of very little value there. A lot of our systems that we use for overflights, unmanned vehicles, ground control systems, spotter aircraft, this kind of thing, are really not of great value, because the forces are mobile, the environment is so hostile, which is why all the military people looking at this have said, how horrible. And they cite, there are very discrete examples. They cite Germany in the Second World War, 30 divisions tied down in Yugoslavia by a bunch of partisans, lightly armed, dissimilar from the people that are there today. I mean, the force comparisons is not dissimilar. Then you get others who say, well, it's actually very similar to Northern Ireland, and look how the British have done in Northern Ireland, fighting in a hostile environment against a really rather small, lightly armed group of people, but it's tied down thousands of extremely well-trained troops and very experienced as well. And then you get others who say, particularly in the Pentagon, who say, remember the Lebanon? We went in there, we had no clear goal, the enemy were unclear, our chain of command was very uncertain, and we got a very, very bloody nose that damaged both our military and our foreign policy goals in the region and continues to do so. And then, of course, you get the Vietnam example, where you have an unconventional environment, guerrilla warfare. And although Vietnam was very different in many ways, the specter of committing troops in large numbers and getting tied down in a very intractable environment and in a war that has very unclear ends, then Vietnam is a similar sort of parallel. So you've got all these things that are being raised up as specters to try and focus the politicians to say, oh, well, okay, if you want us to do this, be aware that there is going to be some heavy costs here. Having said all that, of course, the military will always say to you, look, this is all too difficult and it's going to cost lives. And the military always hate committing equipment, committing to an environment where they're going to lose lives. But the recognition, of course, is that war does cost lives. It is a horrible business. And the military will always be the last to go for it. But the politicians have got to have the commitment to force them to say not, well, why can't we do this? But I want you to do this. Tell me how best to achieve it. And that's where we are at the moment.
How is this region, Bosnia-Herzegovina, how is this region in the interest of the United States? There certainly is no oil there. But beyond the immediate concern about the civil war and the atrocities happening there, why should the United States get involved? What interest does this country have there?
Right. There are two answers to that. I mean, there are probably several, but there are two that immediately occur. First, there is the moral argument, which is very persuasive. The United States was born out of revolution, out of difficult circumstance, is the democracy leading the world, is the most important nation in the world. The world looks to the United States for leadership, for example, and it looks to it for strength. And in this case, there is a clear need for leadership, for a moral example. This is an appalling state of affairs that cannot be allowed to continue. It is killing on an enormous scale. It is deprivation on an unacceptable scale. So there is a strong moral argument to do something. There is perhaps more, I don't know whether it's more important, but it's certainly as significant as the strategic argument. In the world, the United States, the world is a very small place now, the United States is dependent upon relations with the Europeans, with the Eastern, with the Far East, with the Near East, with the former Soviet Union, with the former communist countries in the Eastern Bloc. Out of the former countries of the communist governments in Eastern Europe, will come a huge new trading area upon which the growth of the economies in the European community, certainly, and certainly in part in the United States, will depend into the next century. If we are to allow that part of the world to collapse into insurrection, civil war, bloody conflict, and there is the potential there for Yugoslavia to spread to every single country that used to be part of the Eastern Bloc. If we allow that to occur, two things will happen. One, the potential for economic growth in the world will be significantly diminished. And two, the potential for conflict spreading to other countries, not least the United States, which has, after all, a very large population based that immigrated from the former Eastern Bloc, for conflict to spread to other countries. And it was not that long ago, after all, 5 years or so, when all war plans began with exactly this conflict. The next world war began with what we're seeing now in Yugoslavia. Now, what we want to avoid is a conflict spreading to other countries and perhaps to the Western world. And for that reason, we must do something, and we must do it resolutely.
James Adams, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
James Adams is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times of London. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Journalist Neil Sheehan won a Pulitzer for his book, A Bright Shining Lie, about America's disastrous involvement in Vietnam. He covered the war for the New York Times. Recently, he returned to Vietnam for the first time and was surprised by the depth of his own reactions. Coming up, a talk with Neil Sheehan. His new book is called After the War Was Over. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Gary Shanley's new HBO show that feeds off the talk show frenzy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush announced this morning that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico have now reached agreement on a North American Free Trade Agreement. This accord, which lowers trade barriers among the three nations, must still get congressional approval. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Today's announcement by President Bush came only hours after the negotiators from the three countries had worked out the last few remaining issues. The pact would create the world's largest trading bloc, 360 million consumers in the three countries. The agreement has been a key element of the president's economic plan. He predicts the increased trade that would result from the agreement would create 400,000 new jobs in the U.S. over the next few years. Labor groups, however, have expressed concern that some U.S. jobs might be lost to lower-priced Mexican labor. And environmental groups are worried that the accord might weaken existing U.S. environmental rules. At the White House, I'm Eric Weiner.
NBC News is reporting that Secretary of State James Baker will take the place of Samuel Skinner as White House Chief of Staff while overseeing the president's reelection campaign. Quoting Bush administration sources, the network said the move may be announced as early as tomorrow. There has long been speculation that Baker would take an active hand in the president's campaign, but as to what effect this move would have on the present White House staff has been unclear. The Associated Press, quoting a GOP official, says there is also the possibility that Baker could take the post of White House counselor, with Skinner staying on as White House chief of staff. UN officials have reached agreement with factional leaders in Somalia to deploy 500 troops to make sure that food supplies get through. This comes after a call from the human rights group Africa Watch that has warned unless troops are sent, continued fighting would keep limited food supplies from getting to those who need it. Catherine Bond of the BBC reports.
After months of stubborn resistance from General Idid and his allies, today's agreement to allow the deployment of 500 armed UN soldiers in Mogadishu itself is a considerable breakthrough. But it has its limits. For a start, the soldiers, most likely to come from Pakistan within 2 or 3 weeks with support staff, will be confined to the capital at a time when needs out in the countryside are acute. Secondly, it's clear the agreement might be something of a disappointment to the special envoy. It means he will have to renegotiate with Somali leaders if he wants more UN guards to speed up the distribution of food aid. 500, observers say, won't be anything like enough to make a significant impact on a famine so huge.
Catherine Bond of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 10 points to close at 3,320.83 in very active trading. This is NPR News. U.S. officials who have taken part in government efforts to find servicemen missing in Southeast Asia say there is no evidence any are now held prisoner, but some could be there voluntarily. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, they agreed that some Americans likely were left behind in 1973, when the U.S. government announced that all prisoners had been returned or were no longer alive. They also said that there is no hard evidence that missing Americans are alive now, but they said it is possible. In New York City, the UN Security Council has had its first review of Libya's refusal to comply with a UN resolution requiring it to turn over suspected terrorists to the West. Linda Fasulo reports.
Nearly 4 months ago, the Security Council imposed an air and arms embargo against Libya and urged countries to expel its diplomats. The resolution was designed to force Tripoli to surrender suspects accused of blowing up Pan Am Flight 103 over Scotland and a French airliner over Africa. The measure also demanded that Libya commit itself definitively to ending all forms of terrorism. Today, the Council reviewed Libya's lack of compliance with the resolution, noting that the embargo would remain until Tripoli changed its policy. Meanwhile, British Ambassador David Hannay warned that his government was not willing to wait indefinitely and hinted of a push to impose harsher sanctions if Libya fails to hand over the suspected terrorists. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The ocean liner Queen Elizabeth II moved into dry dock today at Boston for work on a 74-foot gash in its hull. A rock has been found some 1,000 feet from the QE2's location when the ship ran aground last Friday night off of Cape Cod. All 1,800 passengers had to be evacuated from the ship. Officials are stressing that investigations of the accident continue. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Neil Sheehan covered the Vietnam War for the New York Times throughout most of the 60s. It was the experience that shaped his life, and he's been trying to come to terms with it ever since through his writing. When Sheehan left Vietnam, he began working on a book about the war. In 1988, A Bright Shining Lie was finally published and went on to win a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. The book combines biography and history to capture the failures and contradictions of America's involvement in Vietnam. Sheehan returned to Vietnam in 1989 to visit the country that had had such a major impact on his life. He went to Hanoi and Saigon and traveled through the countryside. He writes about the flood of memories and his impressions of Vietnam today in a new book called After the War Was Over. Sheehan told me that almost 20 years later, he could still see evidence of the damage caused by our war in Vietnam.
I went to a place called Ben Suk, which had been deliberately devastated. It was north of Saigon in the rubber plantation country. It was in a communist base area called the Iron Triangle. And the U.S. Army had gone in there and just leveled it, moved everyone out and leveled this village. And then the place had been bombed. And I went back to see what had happened. And these people had come back in 1975 and rebuilt the whole thing at great cost to themselves. About 50 people had been killed by unexploded ordnance, which is very dangerous. People are still being killed by that all the time in Vietnam. And they had reconstructed this place at great, great cost to themselves. But when you walked behind someone's house, there was a bomb crater. Bamboo was growing in it, but it was still there. They said the defoliation had caused, they felt permanent damage to the fertility of the soil. Their whole rubber plantation behind the village had been destroyed, and they had replanted 5,000 rubber trees. You see that kind of damage everywhere in the countryside, particularly in the south, if you look.
What kind of attitude did you find towards you? I assume you identified yourself as a journalist who covered the war in Vietnam. Generally speaking, how did the Vietnamese respond to you?
I was quite surprised at the way they responded to me. I would assume, I went there assuming that the Vietnamese would show a lot of resentment toward an American. They have every reason to show resentment toward an American. Obviously, we caused a lot of damage to their country. We fought a long war with them. But I was amazed at their lack of animosity toward Americans. Let me give you an example.
Yeah, please do.
My wife and I were going up, my wife Susan and I were going up to a town on the China border called Lang Son, which the Chinese had seized in 1979 in another war the Vietnamese had to fight after winning their independence from the United States and France. And we had a flat tire, and we stopped by the road in a village to get the tire fixed. And I was standing, I'd gone through the village and talked to people, and I was standing out beside the road, and this man came down on a bicycle. He was a farmer, poor man, gray hair, raggedy clothes, very decrepit bicycle. And he saw me. You don't see many foreigners in villages in the countryside. And he stopped his bicycle as soon as he saw me. And he pointed his finger at me. And he said, in Vietnamese, Lien So, which is Russian. Are you a Russian? I said, I shook my head. And I said, me, American. Ah, he smiled. And he said, Tot, which is good. And then he, by that time, the interpreter who was with me started to kick in. And he said to me in Vietnamese, Americans are good. I said, thank you. And then he said to me, Vietnamese are good, too. Do you agree? I said, yes, I agree. He said, I was a veteran. I fought in the South. I said, where did you fight? and he told me. And then I questioned him about what unit he'd been. I wanted to make sure he really was a veteran, because he said to me, I am a veteran. I fought in the South. And then I said to him, the fighting was really terrible in that area. He'd fought in the rubber plantation area north of Saigon, where the fighting was really awful. And he bent over, and it turned out he was prematurely gray, and he'd lost most of his teeth. He was not that old. And he pointed at his gray hair, and he said, yes, so many bombs, so many shells, so much fighting, my hair turned like this. And then he put out his hand, and he said to me, Hoa Binh, as he took my hand, which is Vietnamese for peace. And then he got on his bike, and he rode off down the road. Now, nobody told that man to do that.
Well, how do you explain that? How do you explain this particular man, and I assume other people in Vietnam, having this generous attitude towards American people?
I kept... at first, I had no explanation for it, because initially, I hadn't... When initially, in Hanoi, where we went first, when officials treated us without animosity, I was, of course, suspicious that this was policy. When I ran into the reality of it, like this farmer in the countryside, I then began to really look for an explanation. The best explanation I could find was, because we ran into it in a number of places, was that it comes out of the history of Vietnam's wars with China, the repeated wars with China. The Vietnamese have been shaped by their geographic proximity to China. They sit right on the border of this big empire. And they won their independence after 1,000 years of Chinese colonization in the 900s. And then since then, they have had to fight repeated wars with China, because every time a new dynasty came to power in China, not always Chinese, the Mongols, for instance, in the 1300s, the communists in the 20th century. Every time a new dynasty comes to power with China, it inevitably invades Vietnam, as the communist emperor Deng Xiaoping did in 1979. And the Vietnamese have had to fight these wars, but then at the end, as they said to me, you can't stay enemies with the Chinese. They're too big. So first you beat them to get your independence and keep to maintain your independence, and then you make peace. And it's part of, I think, the historical cycle of Vietnam that now the war is over, now it's time to make peace.
Did you find major differences between the North and the South? And did you find Vietnam was a unified country? Or is there still the legacy of the fighting that divides the country?
There are enormous differences between the North and the South. The one thing that unites the country is the nationalism, the sense the Vietnamese have of being Vietnamese, which again comes out of this proximity with China. The North is a place where the Vietnamese have lived for thousands of years. I'm talking now about the Red River Delta in the North, right up next to China. It's a very traditional area. People are very hardworking because it's overcrowded and impoverished. Not only is Hanoi one of the most densely populated cities in Asia, but per square acre, but the Red River Delta, which is a very narrow delta, is one of the most heavily populated rural areas in Asia. So it's terribly difficult for these people to make a living. The climate's very inhospitable, but they're very tradition-bound. They're very conscious of how long they have lived on this land. I mean, the original Vietnamese capital that existed before the Chinese invaded way back in, I think, 111 BC, is only 15 kilometers from Hanoi. But when you go down south, you're in a totally different environment. The Vietnamese have only lived in the south since the 1700s, and it's the south is like Vietnam's California, and Saigon is its Los Angeles. I mean, it's a free and easy in the sense of very creative, freewheeling atmosphere.
You describe the difference between Hanoi and Saigon as something that you observed in Saigon, which is a military security officer was having a rather expensive lunch, and he had a gold ballpoint pen in his breast pocket. And you say, really, in the South, people feel more free to openly flaunt corruption.
Or their individual wealth. Yes, you would never see that kind of thing in Hanoi. I mean, there's corruption in Hanoi. There's corruption in the South. The corruption, by the way, is not nearly on the scale it existed during the war, in terms of the Saigon government was totally corrupt. Everything was for sale.
Neil Sheehan is my guest today on Fresh Air, and we're talking about his trip to Vietnam. Also about some of his memories of the war there. He covered the war in the 60s for the New York Times. He returned to that country in 1989, and he's written about it in a new book called After the War Was Over. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Neil Sheehan. How do the Vietnamese talk about their missing in action?
They don't talk about them unless you ask. When you ask, they talk very freely about them. Let me give you an example again. I went to see, one of the first people I went to see was the editor of the military newspaper in Hanoi. He's a man who spent his life fighting the war, was fairly free, was a man who talked quite freely. He was about to retire. He was a general named Tran Kong Man. He said to me, "We have no way of knowing how many missing in action we have. There are hundreds of thousands of them. A figure's been put up of 300,000, but that's not reliable because they have no idea. People simply disappeared in the intensity of the fighting." And of course, the Americans did not bury the bodies of Vietnamese in any respectable fashion. If we buried them at all, they were shoved in a pit somewhere with a bulldozer.
Well, what do you make, then, of the efforts in this country to recover Americans missing in action? There are still many people in this country that believe that Americans are still being held prisoner of war in both Laos and Vietnam. In the context of having been back to Vietnam and seen how they remember their missing in action, how do you make sense of what's going on in this country?
I think the missing in action issue in this country has become as traumatic as it has because the war was such a trauma to us. I mean, it was a trauma to deal with. It was a trauma. I described to you my emotions, which I describe in the book, of going back to Vietnam and the flood of these memories coming back to you. But when you go to Vietnam, you spend some time in the country, you realize that there aren't any missing in action in the sense that there are Americans alive there, prisoners who are being held against their will.
What makes you so sure about that?
Because, first of all, the country's a very open country. There are a lot of people wandering through the country. I ran into members of the Irish Water Board on a UN project in Hanoi. I mean, the Americans, you have American veterans going through that. A French cardinal I ran into in Hanoi was back saying masses to the Catholic community there on a tour from the Vatican. There have been rewards out for years about information for missing in action. If the Vietnamese had a group of prisoners, the information would have gotten out. Somebody would come forward with it, if only for the reward. Number one. Number two, it would be physically very difficult to keep people like that alive. You're talking about something that's going on 20 years now. The last Americans that could have been shot down would have been in 1972. I'm talking about American military during the war because we pulled out in January 73. So, and when you go to the north and you see a city which is so incredibly impoverished, you go to hospitals which wouldn't pass inspection as animal hospitals in this country. This is a country where the senior leadership of the country doesn't even have decent medical facilities. How would they keep foreigners alive in a prison for going on 20 years? And why? It would be enormously expensive for them. It would and very, very difficult because Americans require much more high caloric diet than Vietnamese. That's why one of the reasons our prisoners suffered so much. In the north from the diet, particularly those in the south. I had a friend who spent 7 years in the south, whom I mentioned in the first book. And so it would be physically very difficult for them to do it, and it doesn't make any sense. I think the Vietnamese, the value of the American prisoners had to the Vietnamese existed up to 1973, at the time of the Paris Accords. And after that, holding Americans prisoner wouldn't be of any value to them. They wouldn't get anything out of it, to be crass about the whole thing. So it doesn't make sense. I found no evidence that there are any missing in action in Vietnam, and I don't think it would make sense for the Vietnamese to be holding Americans.
Do you think it's time to normalize relations with Vietnam, or do you think it's long overdue?
I think it's long overdue. I don't think we're going to get normalization until after this election, because the MIA issue is a very powerful issue. And I don't think any politician wants to normalize relations with the Vietnamese while we're facing an election, and they could lose the votes of people who think the Vietnamese are holding prisoners. By the way, I want to emphasize that I really sympathize with the families involved. And I don't think that issue is ever going to be settled. There will always be people who think there are missing in action. But I think normalization is long overdue. We should have normalized relations with the Vietnamese long ago. We could have settled issues like this missing in action issue much earlier. That is, in terms of finding out what we can find out. If we had used a lot more carrot and a lot less stick, what the U.S. government has been doing is beating the Vietnamese over the head as much as often as they can with the economic embargo and other hostile actions. And I think it's time to end it. It's time to make peace out of a simple sense of decency, not just for their sake, but for ours as well. It's a decent thing to do. The war is over. However you look at the war, it was a mistake, whether you say it was fought in the wrong way, whether you say it was an unjust war. I mean, everyone agrees it was a mistake. It was a fantasy on the part of the American leadership to think that the Vietnamese posed any threat to us. They didn't. All they ever wanted us to do was to go home. So we caused terrible damage to these people as well as to ourselves. It was a tragedy for both nations, and I think it's time to make peace.
Neil Sheehan's latest book about Vietnam is called After the War Was Over. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. We'll be hearing about the announcement of a North American free trade agreement today, and hear some reaction to it from Mexico City and from Canada. We'll also hear about the biggest mall in America that has opened this week. It's actually been built by a Canadian company just outside Minneapolis. And a report from NPR's Elizabeth Arnold, who's in Houston, Texas, where the Republicans are getting ready for the opening of their national convention. The subject today is the Clinton bashing that so many Republicans down there have been engaging in.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Live on tape from Hollywood, the Larry Sanders Show. Tonight, join Larry and his guests, Harrison Ford, Shirley Jones, Jody Watley, and me, Dana, Hank Kingsley. And now, because only he brings out the natural luster of the wood, Larry Sanders.
Larry who? This Saturday, yet another talk show premieres on TV. Actually, it's a show within a new weekly series that critic David Bianculli says is too good to miss. The Larry Sanders Show is a satirical behind-the-scenes look at a talk show. And the host, Larry Sanders, is played by Gary Shandling. Here's David's review.
It doesn't happen often on TV, but every once in a while, the right idea and the right star are linked together at precisely the right time. This weekend on HBO's The Larry Sanders Show, it happens. This is a time, post-Johnny Carson, post-Dennis Miller, when TV talk shows are being talked about like never before. The so-called booking wars for guests. Arsenio calling Leno a punk ass. David Letterman unhappy that he didn't get Carson's job, wanting out. Dana Carvey wanting in. Whoopi Goldberg and Chevy Chase with their own talk shows on the way. Well, feeding on that frenzy, Gary Shandling and his partner Brad Gray have come up with a sitcom about a Carson-like talk show host. And remember, Shandling was a former regular guest host of The Tonight Show before Leno, so he truly does know what goes on behind the scenes. In The Larry Sanders Show, he lets us in on all of it, and all of it is hilarious. The idea is nothing new. Steve Allen and Sid Caesar poked fun at talk shows in the 50s, and Martin Mull did a brilliant job of satirizing the genre on Fernwood Tonight and America Tonight in the 70s. Before embarking on the innovative It's Gary Shandling show in 1986, Shandling himself starred in a spoof in which he played a Carson-like host celebrating his silver anniversary. And then, of course, there was Dabney Coleman as Buffalo Bill. But Shandling's Larry Sanders outdoes them all. He's funny, insecure, vain, and he's not very nice. Real celebrities, from Carol Burnett to Dana Delaney, show up as themselves, and the regular cast is terrific. Megan Gallagher from China Beach plays Larry's second wife. Jeffrey Tambor from Hill Street Blues plays Larry's on-air sidekick. And Rip Torn, in a role that ought to finally give him the acclaim he deserves, plays Larry's producer. The Larry Sanders Show presents parts of the on-air talk show itself, but also what happens behind the curtain, between the commercials, and back in the offices where writers make fun of the talent and everyone hustles to get the best guests. Here from episode 3 is a conference call in which Larry and his staff try to convince William Shatner, the real William Shatner, to come on the show and do a Star Trek skit. But actually, what Larry really wants to do is amuse himself and his staff by getting Shatner to say the word Klingon.
I mean, isn't Star Trek the most obvious, unoriginal choice you can make? I mean, come on.
Well, actually, you know, it's very much in...
Bill, this is Larry.
Larry, how you been?
Good. I was just walking by and I heard your voice on the speakerphone. I thought I'd pop in because, Bill, I'm really excited about doing this Star Trek thing the guys have written tonight.
Oh, great, a Star Trek sketch. That'll be fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
Good, me too. Say, Bill?
Yeah?
What was your biggest enemy on Star Trek?
DeForest Kelly and I had some problems.
Oh, I mean, alien-wise. Who are the evil aliens who were always after you?
Romulans. There were some Romulans. Saltsuckers. Klingons. There were some Klingons.
I think that's it, Bill. Thanks a lot.
And when a comic shows up to do Larry's show right after taping a Tonight Show appearance, this is how Larry and his producer, who's played by Torn, discuss that breach of talk show ethics.
Artie, he's just a kid. Maybe he didn't know any better about the Tonight Show.
Bullshit. Think about it. He taped the Tonight Show an hour before he came waltzing in here. I'm surprised you didn't smell Leno's cologne on the little rat bastard.
You're right. And he didn't even mention anything about it to me. He's off the show.
The Larry Sanders Show is going to be a big hit for HBO. It's every bit as enjoyable and addictive as Dream On and Tales from the Crypt. And if you're curious about how accurately Shandling has portrayed the backstage world of the TV talk show, look around the dial this week. And notice, in the days prior to his big premiere on HBO, how many talk shows Shandling isn't on.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's technical director is Audrey Vablaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, and Ellen Silva, our research assistant. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
William Volman writes in his new novel, "History is like a string that the cat has swallowed." Drawing events from the poor creature's throat, one is surprised at how much must be disgorged. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Volman about his Seven Dreams series, a symbolic history of the European settlement of North America. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.